Line One brings you this special presentation of Out North's Mental Health Mosaics. Welcome to Mental Health Mosaics from Out North, an arts nonprofit located in Anchorage, Alaska, on the unceded traditional lands of the Dena'ina people. I'm Ann Hillman. The intersection of houselessness and mental health could fill an entire season of Mental Health Mosaics. Mental health issues, holes in social safety nets, a lack of support systems for people with mental illnesses and their families, and so many other issues can all come together and end up with people losing their homes or other safe housing. Unfortunately, we don't have the capacity to do that just yet. Until we can cover houselessness more thoroughly, we're going to introduce some of these issues around housing and mental health through the stories of two people. Sally Gossick and Zach McGee Stunkel want to share their stories and help others understand how some people end up without housing and how they become stable again. A quick note on language in this episode. You'll hear me refer to both houselessness and homelessness. More and more people say houseless instead of homeless because they lack housing. That doesn't mean they don't have a place or a group of people that they consider to be home. In this episode, I defer to the language people use to identify themselves and their situations. Now, meet Sally Gossick. Sally is Yupik. She grew up in Togiak, Alaska on Bristol Bay and spent much of her time with her grandparents and her many brothers and sisters.
My Yupik names are Anuk, Sashkuyak, Sashkudak. My grandma's Inkay for me was Kung Fu Daya Girl, and my grandpa's Inkay for me was Dukniak Nasa. Inkay means teasing. And I grew up my grandpa's oldest granddaughter, but then as soon as I turned of age, he started calling me stinky old woman. Dukniak Nasa. Anuk means mother. Sashkuyak means fried meat. Sashkuyak, I don't know what that means. Kung Fu Daya Girl, because I tried to teach my brother Kung Fu. And I used to be able to jump as high as I was, so my grandma used to always go, she'd go, Kung Fu, are you my Kung Fu Daya Girl? Jump like one, then jump like one, my Kung Fu Daya Girl. And I used to jump. I used to jump as high as I was tall when I was about 5. And then my grandpa, he'd go, no, dungayaka for the Dukniak Nasal. He'd go, he'd tell me, no kisses for the stinky old woman. The old stinky old woman is too stinky. Hoo, the stinky old woman.
Sally says she grew up outdoors, picking berries and helping with fishing.
I grew up preparing the fish.
Back on shore?
Mm-hmm. And it was a lot of fun. Watched my grandma and my grandpa work. My grandpa was, he made ulogs, the knives. He made berry pickers. He put the lead line and cork line on the seines, and he was quick with it too. I remember wrapping up the twine for him. My gram, she did a whole lot of traditional stuff. She grass basket weaved. She did skin sewing. She prepared a lot of native food.
After Sally moved to Anchorage for college, she eventually started living off and on in homeless encampments. She had a son, too, who was living with her parents. She was diagnosed with schizophrenia, with bipolar disorder, and depressive disorder.
If I'm not on my medication, my mind is all over the place. I get too happy, and then out of nowhere, I'll become super sad. It's the crippling depression. And sometimes it would be easier just to go back out on the streets. When I'm that depressed, it feels like I deserve it.
Sally says living in camps had a complicated effect on her mental health. In some ways, she felt protected and supported by the people she was camping with.
Since I've been homeless, like I said, it's so much easier for me to become homeless. I could just go out and go to a certain place, and I'm well taken care of. I am spoiled.
I would love it if you would elaborate on that. Because I don't think anybody would ever associate the words homeless with spoiled.
I'm able to eat. I'm able to sit someplace warm without having to be told to go away. As long as I want. And I'm able to Like, I just get things. A lot of the homeless men, they see a homeless woman,
mm-hmm.
and they'll go out of their way to make sure that they're okay.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
That's not the story that's often told.
Well, with my experiences and the people around me,
mm-hmm.
a lot of the women that I've known
mm-hmm.
were spoiled.
But she also went through really dark and confusing periods when she wouldn't bathe and she wouldn't eat. Sally says when she's not on her medications, her schizophrenia fills her mind with voices that only she can hear. They're very real to her. During her most recent period of living in an encampment, she was going through one of those very dark moments. That's when she first met the bear.
The first day I was digging through an abandoned camp, and the bear showed up. I couldn't go inside, so what I had to do was I threw the tarp over my head. And because I'm schizo, and she comes up right next to the tarp, she's standing right above me, and she goes, "I hear you. I smell you. I know you're there. Next time I want to see your face, you're too close to my cubs." And so I said, "Okay." And she said, "I'm going to let you go to sleep." And I fell asleep.
Sally said she was terrified, but she also didn't care if they hurt her. The bear and her two cubs visited her multiple times. She said the bear told her that she was there to protect her and that she knew Sally could see her and talk to her. They had a spiritual connection, and the bears could see the angels protecting Sally's camp. But Sally also knew that the bears could be dangerous and followed the directions she heard from the mama bear. One day, the mama bear had her cubs introduce themselves to Sally.
She told them, tell me who they are. The older one would go up first and he'd go, "I'm the one you call Yugusak." And then he'd run towards his mom. And then the other one would come up and she'd go, "I'm the one you call Tenryura." And it was smaller and then she'd run off. We'd have lunches. Like, I'd be sitting there washing something or like in my little tent or doing something. A couple times was after I got back from the food bank. And she goes, "Surrender the sour milk." She says, "Surrender the cheese stuffs. Surrender the egg stuffs. You need to surrender the cheese stuffs." I know I'm not supposed to be feeding the bears, but she says surrender them.
The encounters with the bears helped Sally decide it was time to leave the camp and try to live a normal life. More voices had joined the bears, some from her shoes.
And then the shoes that I have on, I kept hearing, "They're my correction shoes. These are my under arrest shoes."
She even felt like she heard the voices of the people driving past on the nearby road, saying they were sick of looking after her. The voices told her it was time to surrender herself to the police for a parole violation. She decided she didn't want to live in camps anymore.
And, I mean, as much fun as it is, as easy as it could be, it's spiritually draining. And mentally, like, having to figure out whether or not the bear's going to show up. I mean, I love the bear. Whether or not somebody's going to try to show up and try to do something. And I was at the point in my life where I wanted something bad to happen. Because I was just tired.
Sally was picked up by the police and ended up in jail.
Like, ended up getting put in jail for 62 days. I was supposed to only be there for 10. If I was there for 10, then I would have been back out on the streets. They made a mistake. Due to COVID, all the cases are being pushed. And public defenders, there's like a lot of them that got put on leave. So all the cases were pushed. Mm-hmm. So I ended up being there for like 62 days. And if I wasn't there that long, I wouldn't have been referred to New Life.
New Life Development is a transitional living center that offers supervision and support, including help with remembering medications and becoming and staying sober.
I would have been back out on the streets and I would have been back into my addiction and back talking with the bears.
And now you're medicated and...
I don't hear those things anymore.
Do you miss it?
Not really. It's loud.
Yeah.
Hearing people that aren't there, that I want to be there, and I'm all by myself? No. I mean, like, I miss hearing my mom's voice, and my dad's voice, and my son's voice, but they're not there. And because I was so lost, I isolated myself, and they quit talking to me for a while. So now that I'm medicated, I don't hear, like, the people talking when they're passing by. I don't have conversations with people silently that are in the room, and I didn't even open my mouth. I don't see the little things running around the room. Like, normally, there's always some kind of little small thing that follows me. We call them singsiyaraks.
Little people?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And they're not there anymore?
No. When I was in treatment, they were all over the place. I was sitting there just watching them run around the room. And they'd pull my attention, too. I'll see them slightly, but they can't pull my attention like they used to. Things can't, if I'm not on my medications, the voices, they'll pull my attention, and I won't be able to focus on what I need to be done, what needs to be done. So a lot of times when I was out in the tents, I'd forget to get food. If I was by myself, I'd forget to get food and I'd forget to get water for days.
Now that Sally's stable, she started reading the Bible again, long an important and grounding practice in her life.
Once God has gotten a hold of your heart for even just a moment, He will never let go. Even if you try to shy away from Him, He once, like I said, even my darkest times, He was there. He has never left me.
She's also held a job for months and was recently promoted.
I know I'm organized. I know I'm clean. I know I like to take care of myself. And I know I like to do things with my hands all the time, and I can do something repetitive. I'm making an doily Afghan. The people around, like, they're so supportive of, like, being sober and doing good. And I know I could do good. And it just, I'm surrounded this time. Last time when I went to school, I was more isolated. I mean, I had my classmates, but when I went home, I was all by myself. So now when I go home, I'm not all by myself, and I've got a support system. And then my family, they're talking to me, and they're super proud of me, and I don't want to do the, falling back down. As easy as it sounds, it's so much easier and so much better for me right now. I am happy. I am super happy right now.
Since recording this interview, Sally finished the program at New Life and is seeking long-term housing. She moved out of the transitional home and is living with her best friend in a motel. She feels like she's stable and in a good place and mentally stronger than she's been in quite some time. Before we continue, please be aware that the next story mentions suicide, self-harm, and abuse. If any of these issues are triggering for you, consider listening with a friend or family member. Okay, back to the show. Zach McGee Stunkel's path in and out of houselessness was very different from Sally's. His childhood was chaotic and involved him going in and out of mental health treatment programs and the Alaska Military Youth Academy.
So, I was also adopted. My family wasn't biological, and it was still chaos at best. One of the things I grew up around was a lot of domestic violence, different types of abuse, neglect, and I was also a latchkey child, which means I was left alone a lot and respected to pick up the responsibilities that adults would handle.
Zach's been a lot more mature for most people his age, for a long time, actually.
That's Corey Farrow, one of Zach's therapists at VOA Alaska. You'll hear his voice from time to time, supporting Zach as he shares his story.
I didn't get to do the childhood worry things. I was expected to maintain and act like an adult as well as accommodate for everyone else's mental health needs, and I was just meant to power and push through it.
Was that a spoken expectation, or?
It was both spoken and expected, and it was often not direct. It was family members would have certain triggers that would be accommodated for, but as soon as I spoke up about mine, it was ignored, pushed aside, or I was told as attention-seeking.
How did that affect you?
Eventually, I got really quiet, and I stopped socializing. I slowly fell deeper into depression. It's one of the reasons I'm a suicide survivor. And it's made it to where I feel like sometimes I'm socially awkward because I don't have those skills that other people were taught at a younger age.
Here's Corey again, talking about Zach.
But always quick to try to take care of everybody else, sometimes more so than himself. Something we're still working on. Zach is quite often quick to help others, but then when he needs it or is needed help with us as a treatment team or whoever, he waits till after the fact. Something will pass or whatever it may be. And he's like, oh, by the way, kind of like in passing.
Yes. I think it's something I feel guilty for because I was expected to take care of myself. So I've learned to just deal with it. And if it is a big situation, I often catch myself being like, I'll figure it out. I don't know what I'm doing, but I'll figure it out.
Yeah, it's that burden piece. He doesn't want to be a burden. Mm-hmm. He said that before to all of us.
After multiple fights with his mom and periods of severe depression, Zach eventually shut down and stopped speaking. Home life was really, really rough. Soon after graduating from high school in 2016, a family friend took him to Covenant House, a youth shelter in Anchorage. It was not an easy transition.
I think the biggest barrier I had to accept was in the beginning, I was completely nonverbal. I didn't talk. I didn't smile. And I was always tucked away in a corner back to the wall. So there was no surprises. That was when I first left home and became houseless. My depression had gotten so bad that I could have been diagnosed as a mute. I just chose not to talk.
Zach jumped anytime someone entered the room, but he didn't think he needed to focus on mental health at first. He just needed a job and stable housing.
I was completely ignoring the mental health side and just throwing myself into work. And I ended up working at a daycare for a little over a year as a lead toddler teacher. And it was okay.
You seem almost baffled by this.
There were, of course, challenges, especially if you're someone with, like, social anxiety and you're around little people all day and then you're around older people at the end of the day.
Yeah.
Also, knowing Zach, it's always funny that he had that job. Just something you would never expect for him to do is work with little kids.
Yeah.
Tell me why.
Just his personality. He's very standoffish, especially with most individuals, but like slow to open up. But once you get to know him, he's a great guy. So just take some time. And then you don't really get that all the time with little ones. You have to like be on 24/7 when they're there. And that's not Zach at all.
So did you learn from the experience? Like, did it help you open up?
No. And like, at the end of the day, I was just tired. And that was a challenge in itself because I would be going back to a shelter where I'd be around 60 plus people, and then I would be in a room that had two other people for the night. So it was constantly running with social anxiety and never having any downtime.
How did you survive that?
I don't know. I think I learned, I don't want to say it's negative coping skill, but one of the things is I've learned to like blast music in headphones to block out everyone else. Or I would find secluded areas in the mall just to hang out. Anything just to get some downtime and relatively away from people.
Zach started self-harming. He found it easier to focus on the physical pain than on the mental pain. Eventually, he ended up admitted to the hospital for mental health treatment. That led to an important and positive change in Zach's life.
The person who was doing my paperwork asked why I hadn't mentioned I was trans. I had filled it out on the paperwork on a whim. I didn't think anything would come from it. And they confronted me. They asked me what my preferred name was. And it was great. I was back in my room and they were doing their like checks and rounds. And I heard them refer to me as he, him, and Zach for the first time. And it's like a huge weight was lifted off my shoulders. And it just felt like I could breathe again. And I was like, okay, I can do this. Accepting that I was trans was a bigger step to accepting the other mental health issues I had to actually work on, as well as I think it started the self-acceptance and forgiveness that a lot of the stuff that I went through was out of my control.
Zach connected with Choosing Our Roots, a program that supports houseless queer youth in Alaska. They helped him find housing and connected him with VOA, where he receives mental health treatment. But he doesn't just go to therapy to work on his trauma or his eating disorder. The program also teaches life skills, including balancing budgets, buying healthy foods, and other adulting tasks. Corey, the therapist, explains.
Because if those are in line, then he's not stressing about finances, which also then impact his mental health. So it all just really connects together, so we can't just kind of piece it off by itself.
Zach agrees. Everything is tied together.
The way I look at it is if you're not focusing on your mental health, you're not going to keep your housing.
Focusing both on mental health and the life skills that give people the space to focus on mental health makes it much easier to maintain secure housing for the long term.
So, say a client has had the police called to their apartment in the past or whatever, or wherever they're living, for mental health concerns, whether they're having like a psychotic break or they're having just very active suicidal ideation. The police are the one, are the ones that are usually going to come and check that out. Landlords don't like police to come to their apartments a lot of the time to do safety checks or really anything because it doesn't look good to the other tenants there. So having that come and having that on your history or having arrests or anything like that, that all kind of plays factors into it. The majority of individuals have mental health concerns, whether it's they have ADHD like myself or they have depression, OCD, whatever, and they're all mental health concerns. They can work on those. They don't need extra things in place to kind of tell them that they're worthless.
Mental health shouldn't be a barrier for trying to find a home or an apartment. I've had some issues because, like, I was diagnosed with PTSD in 2018, and one of the things is I have night terrors. One night, I remember waking up. I'm pretty sure I screamed at some point, and I was definitely crying, and my neighbor came up and very aggressively knocked on my door and told me to quiet down, and then complained the following morning to the management, but because the police weren't called, there was nothing they could do.
So a situation like that could eventually lead to an eviction.
Yeah.
And then if you have an eviction, most landlords don't want to rent to you. But if they had, like, maybe researched why that eviction happened, and it would have been related more towards mental health concerns, and they had a better understanding of mental health, then maybe that would have been alleviated for future instances. But
both Corey and Zach emphasize that if the public learns more about mental health and develops empathy for people with different life experiences, it can help prevent people from losing their housing. Zach also wants people to learn from his personal story, to understand that they are not alone.
So when I first became houseless, I pretty much thought it was hopeless in the beginning. It wasn't until while I was working at the daycare that another employee, who is still on the younger side, but I would say in their late 20s, stated to me that they were once in Covenant House themselves, and that they now had an apartment and their own home and pet and all of that.
And that person was an inspiration?
Yep. It made me realize that it is possible that you have to put in the work, which is, I think, something else I'm working on mentally. I don't accept all of the work that I've done. It's almost like imposter syndrome.
I love it. Self-awareness is growing.
Because logically, I know I put in the work, but emotionally, I still feel like I haven't done anything and I don't deserve to be where I'm at.
Even a few months ago, that would not have been the case. That would not have been the answer. I'm like, but I've not done anything to deserve this. Or whatever the answer may have been. So that's why I love this.
So now you realize you deserve stability and you deserve housing.
Yes.
When other people are feeling hopeless and like they feel like they can't get out of it, what are your words for them?
It's hard. It's really hard because you don't see a way out. And more often than not, if you get caught up in the drama of the shelter life, you're going to stay there. You really do have to kind of focus on yourself and try not to get involved with the cliques. Like, you can make friends, but don't let it drag you down.
Corey, what do you think people should take from Zach's story?
That the situation that you're in right now is not forever. Zach did put in the work. Zach had the motivation and the drive to change his circumstances. It's taken some time to get where he's at, and he's not done. He's continuing to grow and move forward. But yeah, it can happen. It is difficult, though. Society, culture, other people, whatever, there are going to be barriers at times. Like, some of our clients just have a whole lot of barriers just to being housed, just to feeling that they're an actual human. They deserve even some of the basic necessities. But Zach's been able to do it. I think the majority of people can get there as well.
A huge thanks to Sally, Zach, and Corey for sharing their stories. Everyone deserves safe housing. It's a basic human right. But as both Sally's and Zach's stories remind us, mental health problems can make us feel like we don't deserve it. Our minds can make us feel less than human. So what's the very, very least any of us can do to reduce people's barriers to housing? Educate ourselves and others about mental health issues and remind people that everyone deserves to be treated like full humans. We all deserve safe homes. And then you can start talking to your local lawmakers about funding long-term supportive housing projects and mental health treatment centers and changing policies around zoning laws. And as I said at the top of the episode, it's a really big issue. These are just two stories presenting two experiences with many, many lessons. When we come back for the second half of this special presentation of Mental Health Mosaics, we'll talk about how the emergency response system is evolving to support people in crisis.
You're listening to Line One from Alaska Public Media. You can find Line One on alaskapublic.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
Are you ready to start accelerating your child's future through education? The Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program is expanding its reach with new opportunities in Juneau and Southeast Alaska. With ANSEP's Acceleration Academy, high school students can earn college credit, save thousands of dollars in college costs, and experience fun, hands-on learning. ANSEP, it's a better way to learn. Learn more and enroll at ansep.net/acceleration. This message sponsored by ANSEP.
Welcome back to this special presentation of Mental Health Mosaics from Out North. I'm Ann Hillman. In the United States, one of the first things we're taught to do in case of an emergency is to call 911. But there's a problem. If you're in the midst of a mental health crisis, 911 can't always provide the help that you need, and there aren't many other options. I spoke about the need for better crisis response resources with Katie Baldwin-Johnson, the Chief Operating Officer at the Alaska Mental Health Trust. Katie says that response to a mental health crisis shouldn't default to uniformed police officers.
Individuals that experience a mental health crisis often don't have the services and the resources in the community to best respond to those individuals in a way that doesn't require a uniformed law enforcement officer to be a part of that equation in some way. And also, doesn't require an over-reliance upon our hospitals and our emergency rooms as the primary place for people to get help. And that dynamic is exactly what Alaska has been facing and still is facing currently.
Katie says involving police at the scene of a mental health crisis has another effect as well.
I think the other piece to that is that it creates that stigmatization, basically putting a mental health crisis or somebody that's experiencing that situation into a criminalized perspective.
And just a note up front, the Mental Health Trust provided Mental Health Mosaics with a grant to support its development, but the Trust has no editorial input on our programming. Katie will be back later in the show to talk about Crisis Now, a new mental health crisis response model that's taking root in Alaska and in other parts of the United States. In many places, it's already creating better outcomes for people facing a mental health crisis. But if you've never been in crisis, it might be really hard to imagine why the existing system can be so harmful. Hearing from Tatok might help you understand a bit better. Please note that her story does touch on suicide and self-harm.
My name is Tatok Helena Muma. I'm from here in Anchorage and traveled a little bit, but Anchorage is definitely my home.
Tatok is a mother and a grandmother and loves creative outlets like singing, crocheting, and playing musical instruments. She has experienced a great deal of past trauma and grief and bouts of serious mental illness. She attempted suicide 15 times over about 20 years. Each time was triggered by something different. Some of her suicide attempts were planned in advance. Others weren't. The one thread that runs through all of those experiences is that they were fed by complicated, conflicting emotions.
Maybe it was like I was holding in a lot of pain, but it's a lot more than that, too. There's a lot of things I just, you know, can't talk about. You know, it's like that the shame and the guilt that goes with it. And, you know, you hold these things down and stuff them down and go in circles with this. And then, well, the people that take it and just like dismiss it and act like it's not there and then feed into it as well. And it just feels like everything that happened and the trauma itself could have been lost as well during this moment. You start feeling a loss of control, you know, it's more than just an explosion because I feel that, but it's feeling overwhelmed and trying to get words out that you can't. And it just goes everywhere.
From what you're describing, it's almost like there's so much happening and so much happening in your mind that you're almost like weighed down, but at the exact same time, you feel like you're going to explode.
Yes, all the above.
Okay.
Everything, all the above. And it just has nowhere to go. And sometimes it came out in rage at times, and other times it didn't. It came out in tears.
Tutok says she remembers feeling like when the police have shown up, they didn't always see that she was in crisis or listen to her. And because she was having trouble communicating about the situation, she struggled to explain what was happening to her emotionally as well. She felt like they only saw other parts of what was happening, like potential domestic violence.
And I'm sitting there suffering, sitting here wondering what's going on. You know, everything that I had was being denied. You know, if I need medical care, they'll let the ambulance know so I can be taken care of. But they, you know, do what they can to ask me questions. But I've gotten to the point where when they ask me these questions, it gets me nowhere. And sometimes, you know, and when I'm talking to people about it now, it's like, you know, you can ask for a chaplain if you need it. And it's like, I know I can ask for one, but I'm also not being offered a chaplain either. And these things that I know, I don't think of when I'm in crisis. And, you know, these can be offered to me that we have these services, but I'm sitting here left alone trying to figure out what to do. And I can't explain it to them sometimes. And it comes out in anger a lot more than anything because, you know, I've gone through it so many times and it's just like nobody wants to listen. It's just like you're here to do something and pass me off, you know, and then I go to the next person and it's like, that's not what I want. I need to be tended right now during this environment that I'm in and it's not being taken care of. So, yeah.
Tutok says that when she's in crisis and things feel chaotic, she really just needs a safe place to talk, far from violence, and far from people making assumptions and judgments about her. But that's impossible for her to explain in the moment of crisis.
Maybe if I harmed myself or something and telling somebody, you know, and it's I'm scared, you know, they're going to take my rights away, you know, so why would I tell somebody something when it's already going to do more harm than good? It's like we're adding trauma on top of trauma after that.
Tutok says that she was involuntarily committed to psychiatric wards in the past and was forced to take medications she didn't want. She doesn't want that to happen again, so she tries to tell people what she needs while also limiting how much she shares. It sometimes makes the problems worse.
We shouldn't be scared of, you know, telling these people that, hey, I harm myself and I need help and I shouldn't be ridiculed or, you know, or dismissed or denied or act like I'm not there because people talk around me like I'm not there. And it's like, hello, I'm looking at the people there and it's like, what about me? And then I lose all decisions and everything that happens. And, you know, it makes me feel that much smaller and that I don't matter in these moments. And, you know, you lose your voice and you sit there and left in your thoughts while they make the decisions for you.
So you feel like you're completely not heard, like you're almost invisible, even though it's supposed to be about you.
Exactly.
And like you don't have control over decisions that are being made about you.
Correct.
And this is how you feel when you're in crisis in general or when like emergency responders show up because you're in crisis?
I think all the above in any kind of crisis. I mean, just even taking the time to stop to see what we can do sometimes doesn't seem like it's enough when things keep going on and it's like, what do you do about it besides go emotional, I guess the best I can put it.
Go emotional.
I don't know how else to put it. Go crazy, go emotional, and just let everything out all at once is how I feel. It's what I would put it.
That's a good way of putting it because you just, I mean, you can only hold on for so long, right? Or hold in for so long.
Yeah, that's pretty much it. That's kind of where everything gets stuffed down and then kind of go around in circles with this.
In the past, when you've been in crisis, have you ended up at an emergency room before?
I've had friends take me in. I've had the ambulance called on me. So it's just been different ways. Yes. Mm-hmm. The ambulance doesn't show up first usually. It's very rare. And if they do, they usually are not equipped to help me. So they're kind of lost if they come show up first. and they've told me that. So they usually wait for somebody to come. It kind of makes it feel awkward while they sit there and wait. So it's like, now what? And so, like, it depends if I've harmed myself, if they give me the care that I need, or if I don't.
Tatok says there was one experience with a police officer who really helped her. She treated her like a whole person.
I will say, like you say, I did have an officer, a lady, who did, when she took me into the hospital, she heard my bullshit. And she said, you know what, I just want to listen to you. And she sat there and said, what's going on? And she got down to the bottom of it. And she goes, I know you really need help. And she goes, you know, then this is what I can do. And she took me in, and I know I was detained. But when she took the handcuffs off of me, she actually gave me a hug. And she did this in front of everybody there. And it just, we need more of that. We really need more of that, because the way she made me feel, it was like no other. When she did that, and like you said, it was like the first time I was heard, and I felt like it was the only time. But I hold on to these kind of moments too, more than people think. So yeah. I tell you, that day made a difference. It really made a difference that day.
Tatok is tired of feeling alone because of her mental health issues. She's speaking up about these topics to show what she's overcoming. She doesn't want people to feel sorry for her. She wants them to advocate for systems change. She says what would really help her in the long term to break the cycle of crisis after crisis is having folks who check in on her regularly and in person after the immediate crisis is over. Someone who can help her navigate local resources and help advocate for her. She needs what is starting to be provided through things like the mobile crisis teams and the Crisis Now model. Crisis Now brings together mental health crisis management solutions that have worked in communities across the United States. It's framed around the idea of meeting people where they are at and providing the right type of care immediately. For most people, they really just need to be listened to and connected to resources. The Crisis Now model includes both telephone support, like crisis lines, and in-person support from people who are trained to deal with mental health issues and de-escalate situations. In Alaska, there's always someone available to listen through the Care Line, which is based in Fairbanks. The people there understand the challenges Alaskans face and know how to help. They'll listen and connect you to local resources if you need them. Their number is 1-877-266-4357. And if you're listening to this after July 16th, 2022, no matter where you are in the United States, you only have to call 988 to connect to a local crisis line. Statistics show that for about 90% of the people who call a crisis line, that support is enough for dealing with the immediate issues. For others, they need someone to arrive in person. That's where the mobile crisis teams come in. Problematically for Alaska and other rural places, the teams are mostly in urban areas. Logistically, it's too hard to have them in really small and spread out communities. But it's clear that mobile crisis response teams are effective. There have been these types of programs in Arizona, Oregon, and Georgia for decades. They decrease the strain on emergency response systems and connect people in crisis with the care they need in that moment and afterwards. They launched in Fairbanks and in Anchorage in 2021. In Fairbanks, mobile crisis teams include mental health clinicians and peer support providers, who are people who have faced their own mental health issues and have had to navigate local networks of support providers. Carrie Phillips is one of the peers who works for The Bridge in Fairbanks, and she also answers calls at the Care Line. Before that, she worked as a 911 dispatcher. We spoke in late 2021, about a month after the mobile crisis teams started responding to calls.
I am Carrie Phillips, and I am the team lead for the mobile crisis team in Fairbanks, responding to callouts from our 911 center for people that are in any type of crisis, either with law enforcement and the fire department, or just with myself as a peer and with a clinician.
What is this whole process like? Like, what is it from start to end?
So it kind of depends. Like, every call is going to be unique. I guess for me, it's a little bit different because I worked for a 911 service for 11 years. And then I've also worked for the state suicide hotline at Caroline. And so I've done this over the phone for years. And so doing it in person is just really not that much different, other than you have more of a connection. I think you can do a little bit more. And I think sometimes when somebody's going through a mental health crisis, no matter what it is, having somebody there to be able to validate their feelings and to empathize with them, I think it's just another, a better step up for them. You know, trying to keep them out of jail or out of the hospital, which 9 times out of 10 doesn't really do anything for them except make the problem worse.
So can you talk about, like, what this is like from your perspective as someone who's worked with 911? Like, when a call comes into 911, how do you know if they just need peer support and a clinician versus if they need something else?
So for me, it's kind of a gut instinct. If they're not violent, if they're not actively suicidal to where they have a plan and they have the means, like they've got a gun in their hand, you know, and they've locked themselves in a room, we've gone on a call like that. But obviously law enforcement was present. If somebody calls in and is just very lonely and is thinking about suicide and they're not violent, they have no known weapons, then sending a peer and a clinician is going to be a little bit better than sending a peer clinician in the police department. Because when the police department shows up, that usually escalates, you know, no fault to them. But when a man shows up in, or a woman shows up in uniform and you're having a mental health crisis, it usually escalates at a lot more than it should.
Have you been there?
I just know from the 911 side of thing or the Caroline side of thing, a lot of people know that we're mandated reporters. And if there's an imminent harm to yourself or to others, we have to call law enforement. And a lot of people don't like that. And if it's going to piss the caller off more, if I'm talking to him at the Caroline, I don't even tell him I'm sending law enforcement. So I can at least keep them on the phone and keep them where they're at until law enforcement can arrive. And it's usually just because they, one, because they're going through a mental health crisis, or two, because they've just had a bad experience with the police department before, mm-hmm. You know, so it's a little different. I think every 911 dispatcher would, you could give them all the same call and some would respond to it by sending out just the peer and clinician, and some would be on the safer side and send peer, clinician, and fire department. It's just kind of it's a judgment call. I mean, a lot of 911 is a judgment call. There's a lot of discretion. Like, you had to listen to your gut. And it was always, you know, when in doubt, send them out.
Carrie says that when the mobile crisis teams receive a call, they often get a little bit of history about the caller, if it's available. That helps them know when it's safe to go by themselves or when it's good to have others on the scene with them. Her team has also spent time explaining what they do to the police department so the police know when to reach out.
We've gone to a couple of roll calls with the police department for the guys, like, on the street to let them know, hey, this is why we're here. This is what we do. And they've asked me that. Well, they're like, well, if we know we have to take someone to the hospital, do we still call you guys? Well, yeah, I would. Because if you call us and we're able to calm them down and commit them to safety, then you don't have to take them to the hospital. There's been a couple of times we've helped people just over the phone. Like, there's a lot of people that kind of call 911 on a regular basis for not 911 related things. They should not be tying up a 911 line for it. And so that's where we can kind of step in. And instead of them calling 911, they could call us and we could talk to them over the phone, or they could call the Caroline. Some people still don't know about the Caroline.
Carrie says she also explains to police officers that they are there to help the entire emergency response system be more effective.
You know, our number one goal, obviously, is to help people. We want to be able to get them to the services that they need, you know, to become healthy, productive members of society in whatever way that looks good for them. And then number two is to help take a load off of you guys, because you aren't clinicians, you aren't mental health responders, and you know as much as I know that you show up on a scene in uniform with a gun on your hip, that's going to escalate the scene 9 times out of 10. So we want to make it less stressful or less busier or less annoying for 911, for the fire department, for the police department. Because we don't have a lot of police officers either. We are very short-staffed.
Another major role of the mobile crisis team is to provide long-term support for people. Mental health crises aren't one and done events.
Just go and see them the one time out in the community and that's it. We do follow up and make sure we can connect them to services, make sure they have a ride. So the person on follow up, that's all they do. Whether they go to the person's residence or meet them where they're at, we don't just see them the one time, say, hey, these are the people that can help you and just drop it, because it's not going to do any good. And I'm sure that's what people have done to them their entire life when it's come to stuff like this.
As Carrie and I were talking, she received a call. She immediately grabbed her purse and an iPad that she uses to write down information about the situation once she arrives on scene. Then she headed downstairs to wait for the mental health clinician. She was wearing everyday clothes and looked like a person you'd see at the grocery store. Her presence was calming and normal. We sat in the echoey hallway and continued chatting. She wasn't sure what to expect that evening.
So again, every call is different. It really just depends on the needs of the person. Whether they just needed someone to talk to, if they needed someone to, you know, talk them off the ledge, if they needed to go to the hospital, we could take them, again, as long as they're not violent, you know. Mm-hmm. I think us taking them to the hospital, again, would be a lot calmer than the police department taking them. However, I know this from experience, if the police officer transports you, and as long as you're not violent, not agitated, not being, you know, abrasive, all they do is just pat you down and put you in the back of the car. They don't cuff you, which is helpful. But again, some people in a mental health crisis can't remain calm. And yet, putting cuffs on them is going to make it 10 times worse. So if we can take them rather than law enforcement or the fire department even, it would be a lot better.
At what point do you decide it's okay to leave the person?
Again, it's kind of like a gut instinct. You got to make sure they'll commit to safety if they were suicidal. If they're intoxicated or high or whatever, that as long as they're okay to still like maintain themselves and help themselves, and you know what I mean? It really is, again, some discretion on your part. And it's kind of nice that you have two people there that you can like go back and forth being like, okay, this is the reason why I think we should let them stay here. These are the reasons why I think we should transport them. But we always kind of err on the side of caution. And that's why I come up with, when in doubt, you know, send them out to where we would send them to the hospital. Or even sometimes just calling a family member saying, hey, this is what, you know, with their permission, this is who I am, this is what's going on, could you come over and stay with them for a little while? Mm-hmm. I've done that at the Caroline, where I've called, you know, people's sisters and say, hey, your sister's kind of going through something. I would feel more comfortable if somebody was there watching her. Are you able to do that? And they say yes, then great. If they say no, then you're going to have to like reevaluate and be like, okay, I don't feel comfortable leaving you here alone. You're either going to have to go to the hospital or we're going to have to find somebody else to come over. But as long as they can commit to safety and, you know, they're not on a level 10 anymore and they're back down to like a 2 or a 1, then I'm okay with leaving them.
Carrie says the in-person calls can last a few minutes to a few hours. Either way, having the mobile crisis teams on scene lets officers respond to other community needs instead. It also prevents people from being taken to the hospital or to jail just because the police don't have the capacity or the skills to help them. Moments later, the mental health clinician arrived in a generic, unmarked SUV, and they were off to help the caller. So, what if the mobile crisis team can't provide the care people need? Then what? That's where the gaps in Alaska still exist. One place people go is to the emergency room. As Katie Baldwin-Johnson from the Mental Health Trust explains, the emergency room isn't the right place for a person having a mental health crisis.
An emergency room department is a very sterile environment, and it's overstimulating, and it's you've got people changing shift, you've got, you know, just, you know, a lot of light. It's not a calming environment, and it's an artificial environment, really.
Katie says that can lead to dangerous conditions for both the patient and the healthcare worker. Not every hospital employee is trained to handle mental health crises. That's why the Trust, behavioral health providers, and other organizations across the state are trying to build out the Crisis Now model. One of the major missing components is a 23-hour stabilization center.
And that's really what this whole component of care is a stabilization setting that is trauma-informed, that is highly staffed by people with lived experience in combination with mental health professionals. And it's really a multidisciplinary team. But it's a setting where anyone can go and when they need it, and that they will be received. And those folks that are working in that program will do what they can do to help that person. And a majority of the time, they're going to help that individual by getting them engaged in other services or help them problem solve maybe the situations that have resulted in them feeling like they need additional support. So these settings alternative to an emergency room department are really key, because we really don't need everybody going to the emergency room department. I mean, this is not a medical emergency. It is a healthcare emergency. But there are folks that, you know, can more appropriately respond. And so it's really about thinking about building in that additional rung in the ladder. We want more than just your inpatient state hospitalization, hospital, emergency room departments, and outpatient care. We need something that gives us more opportunity to help address the issue earlier on at lower levels of care. That's really kind of the premise behind the stabilization setting.
Stabilization centers provide recliners instead of beds, and folks only stay there for 23 hours, so they can be considered outpatient treatment. They provide more support than a mobile crisis team can without adding the trauma of a hospital. In Arizona, where the centers have been very successful, they offer most people space immediately, and they always take people who are brought in by emergency responders. Developing these in Alaska requires policy changes to support licensing new types of facilities and to change civil commitment statutes. We also need new facilities to be developed and long-term commitments on behalf of care providers. It's a complicated process that's been in the works since late 2018 and may not be finalized for a while.
And really, I think we're looking at this is a reform of the way we are responding and how communities can more intentionally coordinate care for individuals that just otherwise are really falling through the cracks. And so this fits at a very core level with the trust mission and is, you know, very important work for us to do. Now, we know that there's always question about, you know, how will this be forever paid for? How will this be sustained? And, you know, we knew that there was the mechanism through the 1115 waiver.
That's a new way to get Medicaid to pay for mental health care.
That there's the opportunity to support moving in this direction. So there's synergy with that. Long term, however, it's going to be greater than just the trust to really figure out if the state of Alaska really wants to do better and respond better to people in crisis, and we really want to start looking at preventing and reducing our horrible numbers of suicides and people suffering across the state, that this is the work that's important for us to do.
You can learn more about how communities around the nation are shifting their mental health crisis response systems by going to mentalhealthmosaics.org. There you can also find art and creative prompts around this and many other mental health topics. This episode was edited by Jenna Schnur, produced by me, Ann Hillman, with audio mixing by Dave Waldron and Eric Bork. Our theme music is by Aria Phillips. Mental Health Mosaics receives funding from the Alaska Center for Excellence in Journalism, the Alaska Mental Health Trust, and the Alaska State Council for the Arts. Thanks for listening.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters. Learn more about Line 1 and listen online at alaskapublic.org. This is Alaska Public Media.